Well, thank you so much for being here.
No worries. Thanks so much for the opportunity.
We really do appreciate it, and looking forward to it.
Oh, good. Thank you. Thank you.
We're down to two people, you noticed.
I know that, yes.
So
I'll still keep it to 15 minutes.
I think that's good.
We have a longer discussion.
We'll have a longer discussion. I think people really enjoy that. And yeah. Mostly, you've noticed, there hasn't been much discussion.
No, that's right. That's good. That suits me, too.
Michael, is it okay? That's okay. That won't fluster you if I pass you a note for 5 minutes or something like
no,
that.
No, you mean as a to wind up?
Yes.
You know, that'd be helpful. Thank you.
Oh, very good.
Do you want me to grab some? Oh, you do have some water.
I've got some water. Thank you, man.
Do you want me to
grab some? I'm fine. Thank you. Thank you. I can tell that we have a number of very enthusiastic discussions continuing, some of them outside of this hall, who ask you to bring yourselves to order. Thank you again for your attendance this morning. In our last session before lunch, people are probably anxious to get to lunch, but we're grateful for your attendance this morning in this session, which is on the religious and theoretical understandings of secularism. My name, again, is Gary Doxey. I'm an associate director of the center here at the law school at Brigham Young University. In your program, I'm substitute. You see James Toronto, one of our professors. I'm substituting for him this morning. They had a family funeral that he had to attend. And those things are always unexpected. And so I'm substituting for him this morning. And I hope to do an sufficient job in his absence. He's a remarkable man whom I admire very much. We have a distinguished panel this morning. Professor Joseph E. David, who also shows up on the program, was shifted to a different session earlier this morning, and so we're down to two people. And we've agreed among ourselves that we're going to keep we're not going to lengthen the presentations. We're going to instead have more time for discussion, which should be very interesting. We have Professor Andrea Pin, who's a professor at the University of Padova in Italy. And we also have Michael Casey, who is private secretary of the Catholic Archdiocese of Sydney. We're so grateful for their presence today. You can find many fascinating facts about them in the program, so we won't take time now to go over them, but I just want you to know that they're distinguished and very capable. We look forward to hearing from them. We'll begin first with Michael Casey and then Andrea Pin.
Thank you, Gary, for that very kind introduction. And I'd just like to repeat or add to the words of thanks that other speakers have offered to the Brigham Young University Law School for hosting this fantastic symposium. It's been a tremendous opportunity to really learn a lot about what's going on, to really learn a lot about what's going on around the world on this very important issue. So as my contribution, a small contribution today to the question of religious and theoretical understandings of secularism, I'd like to offer a few thoughts from some work I'm doing at the University of Notre Dame, Australia, with Dr. Nigel Zimmerman and some others on a book project. And my particular contribution to that project focuses on what I call, following Pope Benedict XVI, the pathologies of religion and reason, or what happens when religion and reason go wrong. It seems that, at least for a lot of human life, complementarity is a condition of good health and fruitfulness. And I think that's the case when it comes to the relationship between faith and reason as well. It also seems that unless faith and reason are either grounded, tempered, or completed in each other, all sorts of distortions become possible. So the pathologies I want to speak about, I think, break out when either, typically when faith or reason refuses to be complemented by the other and claims instead to dominate or to displace it. Religion without reason can become or can descend into the realm of myth, idolatry, and therapy, and reason without religion can sometimes entertain various sorts of madness as its finest flower. Strange things can arise and be justified, or purport to be justified, when the proper relation between religion and reason is overturned. So in what follows, I'd like to briefly discuss, offer a few remarks about the pathology of religion, and focusing on a particular example that Pierre Marnet has offered, in which he talks about the religion of humanity as one version of that. And then as an example of a pathology of reason, I'd like to pick up an example Professor John Finnis from Oxford University has elaborated about the way in which some forms of public reasoning are excluded because of what is assumed to lie behind them. In his magisterial three-volume work on the life of Christ, Pope Benedict, in his reflections on the nativity of Christ, speaks about the journey of the Magi, the three wise men from the East who came to pay homage to the Lord when he was born in Bethlehem. Pope Benedict explains that the concept of the Magi has four principal meanings. The first meaning refers to a priestly caste strongly influenced by philosophy. A second meaning describes them as possessors or users of supernatural knowledge or power. A third meaning has the sense of magicians, and a fourth meaning related to that third one characterises them as deceivers or seducers. Pope Benedict argues that the ambivalence of the concept of the Magi also illustrates the ambivalence of religion generally. It can be or can become the path to true knowledge, or it can, when it's diverted, become something destructive and perhaps even demonic. In the first meaning that Pope Benedict highlights about the Magi, a priestly caste strongly influenced by philosophy, which we might generalise a bit more broadly to talk about religious people open to reason, the inner dynamic of religion to self-transcendence is captured. It captures the search for truth. A search for God is a search for truth. It's philosophy it's an aspect of philosophy in one of its most fundamental meanings. But it's also a search not just for knowledge, but also for wisdom, and for an openness, a willingness to enter into mystery. I use that term mystery not as a form of mystification, but to try to capture the sense we have of some things in our life and experience which we continually return to ponder, and which we grow in understanding of, but which we never ever have a sense of being in possession, of really capturing it and holding it. And I suspect that part of the pathology of religion or reason is underlying it is a conceit that we are in possession of the truth rather than the truth being something which we enter into and join in the unfolding of. Now, in addition to the ambivalence of religion, as Pope Benedict has highlighted, I think we can also make another point about it, which for want of a better phrase, we might use the term, religion is ineradicable. It is an ineradicable part, a fundamental part of the human condition. Rémy Brague, the French philosopher, speaking about the law, has made a point that the law can never be escaped. If we abandon a superior law, we fall under an inferior one. If we renounce the law of reason, we live under the law of instinct, or the laws of nature. And I think a similar logic applies to religion. And Alexis de Tocqueville, of course, the great observer of American democracy in the 19th century, was very interested in the way in which, the role that religion played in the New Republic. And his observation was that unbelief is an accident and faith is the only permanent state of mankind. He added that unless a religion is foolish enough to align itself with a temporal power, it can only be destroyed or displaced by another religion. The third element I'd like to draw on or touch on is the concept of secular religion or political religion. The French political scientist Raymond Aron coined the phrase secular religion in his reflections on communism. And the German philosopher Erich Vogelin spoke about political religions in reflecting on the experience of Nazism in Germany. I think these two examples, quite extreme examples of course, also perhaps highlight the fact that when we talk about secular religion or political religion, it's not just a term of art. In a way, it's another way perhaps of talking about what used to be called idolatry. I should also emphasise that in using the phrase, the apparent contradiction in terms, secular religion or political religion, I don't do this merely by way of drawing an analogy or using a metaphor. If we look at the Latin root of the word religion, it means to venerate and to bind. And the religious instinct involves us in seeking the truth, in finding what we believe to be the truth, something which we venerate as not of our making, not of our own creation, but something uncreated and which we hold to be or think to be of supreme value, and which we then accordingly bind ourselves to, order our lives around. And I think this principle, even in distorted forms, in certain forms of politics and ideology, can also be seen in play as a distorted form of religion. Another element just to mention very quickly is one scholar has observed the lower degrees of the sacred or of religiosity are deeply mimetic or metastatic, which means that they tend to follow things through mimicry, and they also tend to transform one thing into another. So something that, for example, is not strictly a matter of religion, perhaps the natural world or the environment, can be transformed into one. And I think also in the secular political context, the desire for transcendence, which is a characteristic of religion, transcending ourselves and our weaknesses, and also transcending, having a sense of this life being transcended by something which continues beyond it. So that is sometimes replicated or reflected in a spirit of mimicry through political concepts of radical moral regeneration through revolt and violence. I think these revolutionary attempts to overthrow the whole world and create a new order, they are, at one level, an attempt at moral regeneration, but a moral regeneration through violence. And I think this is in some ways it looks like a parody, but that's the wrong word for it. It's a mimicry of the desire for transcendence. Pierre Marnet has spoken about this dynamic of the religious instinct and the religious impulse attaching to secular objects in a recent essay. His observation is that secular religion is a perverse imitation of one point, specifically of the Christian proposition, which is diverted towards the world rather than to the world beyond this one. He argues that in almost every epoch we can find an example of this displacement of a secular religion. And in our age, he argues, the phrase he gives it is the religion of humanity. It's a religion which is based on a sense of common humanity, he argues, rather than focusing on real life in common. And it also incorporates what we might call a religion of human rights, within which, for persons, people who are acknowledged as persons, almost everything is possible and permitted. But for those who fall outside the category of personhood, terrible dangers ensue. And so we find ourselves in a strange situation where we have some philosophers arguing that personhood could be extended perhaps to animals in certain circumstances, but it may not or should not perhaps be extended to newborn children because of that they fail to meet various conditions of personhood in these understandings. John Finnis works in the natural law tradition of philosophy and law, and which I assume most of you are familiar with, but it's a form of reasoning which is philosophical, it's not religious, and it doesn't invoke religious arguments in general. He has made an observation that when it comes to arguing around some of the neuralgic issues of our day, such as issues around life, the status of life in the womb, the status of life at the end of life, the status of life in terminal illness or in disability, and also around questions about sexuality and marriage and relationships. The reasoning that is offered from a tradition like the natural law tradition on these points is often discounted or disqualified on a number of grounds. Firstly, there is an underlying assumption that if one disagrees with certain choices or lifestyles or relationships, even on completely reasoned grounds, that is to disparage or disrespect those who think differently. We see this, of course, typically at the moment, perhaps most prominently at least, in the debates around marriage, where people who defend the traditional understanding of marriage are regularly criticised for not respecting people who have a different view or their relationships. So this reasoned opposition then comes to be characterised as a form of intolerance. Despite the unfolding of this then goes that the reasons that are offered in these reasoned arguments against these things are in fact not reasoning at all. They're merely a vehicle for some sort of disguised bigotry or religious impulse, which obviously of their nature are irrational. And because this reasoning is allegedly used to mask this agenda, people do not need to engage with it or to answer it, which is obviously a very convenient way of dismissing your opponents. The implications of it are quite significant. First and foremost, of course, for the future of reasoned debate in democracies and societies like ours. But they're also significant because they seem to suggest or imply that people who hold certain views, even quite apart from any religious convictions, simply on reasoned reflection on some of these questions, are somehow suspect because they allegedly some sort of irrational impulse which they or bigotry that is behind their arguments which they seek to impose on other people. So we have a situation where people who try to use reasoned arguments without reference to religion to try to uphold the rights of others are accused of denying human rights. Those who insist on respect for the vulnerable and the weak are accused of being disrespectful of others. Those who appeal to reason to make this case are accused of being irrational and prejudiced. And those who appeal to common humanity and a shared human nature are accused of being intolerant and opposed to equality. So I'll wind up now, but I suppose to conclude briefly, what I've tried to illustrate in very broad brush terms is how, in certain circumstances, reason and religion become very strange creatures when they're separated from each other. They become derailed from their true natures. This has implications for us in democracy too. Vladimir Tismanasu has talked about totalitarianism in the Soviet experience as a form of derailed modernity. Well, modernity, I think, can be derailed in democratic societies as well. And I think this is a question that we have to consider, especially when we're in a situation when perhaps rather than giving ourselves to the seeking of the truth together, joining together in seeking and following the unfolding of the truth, we seek to create an artificial reality or a false reality and give it an artificial sacredness, which we then try to forcibly introduce and maintain. Thank you.
Yeah, it worked. Good morning. Thank you again for inviting me again, which means that perhaps you are happy with what I said, or perhaps you hope I have improved. But really, thank you, and great opportunity to be here, and great symposium until now, because now I'm starting to talk. And my position is very troubling because I am the only thing between you and lunch. So I understand that I will be as short as possible, so it would make my talk even more memorable for this reason. That's where I come from. It doesn't have to do with a talk, but so you have an idea why I speak with hands. And if you don't like the way what I say, at least you will like the slides. I'd like to talk, that's serious part, not too much though. I would like to parallel Michael's discourse on the pathology of secularism when it comes to courts. Let me just sketch out in very basic, even dummy terms, what would be the relationship between the religious field and the secular field. It's very common, particularly in Europe, but in Western countries, that when you talk about the relationship between secular sphere and the religious sphere, the way through which the religious thinking has an access to the secular sphere is through the translation. You need to translate your concepts into secular terms. So if you want to speak about, let's just pick one of the subjects Michael was talking about, same-sex marriage, and we are debating about same-sex marriage in politics, you cannot tell me that God wants the marriage to be between a man and a woman. You must give me a secular explanation. And it's the religious thinking that must climb the hill, because it's on the religious thinking that falls the duty of translation. So that works. It should work, it's supposed to work when it comes to political sphere. But recently, a case brought this topic within the court sphere. So can we expect religious thinking, religious law, to be translated into secular terms? So this will be a very short journey around this possibility. And as you will see, it's not remote at all. I will take a case study with you, very, very short case. Quite famous, very recent case decided by the Grand Chamber of the European Court of Human Rights, Fernandez Martinez versus Spain. You have a former priest who taught religion at school, at state school, with the approbation of the bishop, according to the Spanish state and the Spanish Church agreement. He started openly criticizing religious doctrine, Catholic doctrine, around celibacy of priests and other issues. He was fired. He was fired, and under domestic jurisdictions, he lost, brought the case before the European Court of Human Rights, saying that his private life had been violated because the employer had intruded heavily into his private sphere under the Article 8 of the European Convention. And the response and the quite lengthy decision has to do with the idea of scandal. Scandal is well-known canon law technical concept that alludes to the fact that with your teaching of religion, for instance, you might cause scandal to somebody, and this would be an obstacle to other people's faith. So if I don't witness my faith with my teaching, with my life, I'm not supposed to teach at all Catholic doctrine, because this obstacles other people's faith, path of faith. Canon law doesn't have a specific provision on that, but you will find shelves of books on scandal, because it's well-known canon law term. So witnessing Christian life and religious and moral considerations, true doctrine, are all concepts that teachers of Catholic religion should enflesh. And if they don't do that, this would cause a scandal. That's why he was removed. That's the assumption of the case. I don't want to go into the case. One of the dissenting opinions, it was decided sharply, 9-8. So 9 ruled in favor of Spain and found no violation, but 8 filed several dissenting opinions arguing in favor of Fernandez Martinez, of this teacher. One of the dissenting opinion was very powerful, delivered by a very influential and smart professor of constitutional law at the European Central University, Andras Chaillot. I'm not criticizing him now. I'm taking his arguments because I think he's bringing into the legal sphere a very political concept, which is the duty of translation. He says, the idea of scandal hasn't been sufficiently translated into secular terms. Therefore, we cannot address this case properly. If the church and here the Spanish state doesn't provide us with a translation for scandal, how can we address the case? How can we assess the balance between the right, the autonomy, the right to autonomy of the church and the right of private life of the individual? In this way, it looks like it flows, and it's very interesting. So thank you, but no thank you. Translation is needed to protect rights and secure judicial review. That's the argument. The flip side is that if you aren't able to translate your religious belief in secular terms, you lose. It's not because it's not because you have other rights that overwhelm you. That's simply because you don't have an access to the court. That's the thinking behind this idea of translation. So the questions that arise are 4 to me. What is a translation? Why a translation is needed? And who is requested to fulfill the duty of translation? And who decides if translation is okay? The first question, I will be very, very short. Professor Chaillot says that the concept must be made cognizable to the court and intelligible. But it is intelligible in the way that I told you. Concepts must be understood. They surely don't need to be accepted. You don't need to endorse the idea that people must go to mass on Sunday or not to drink coffee. It's not a matter of acceptability. It's just a matter of understanding the concepts. But are there always available secular reasons for religious laws? If I ask a Jewish friend what is kosher, he will tell me. But if I ask him, just now translate me what it means kosher in secular terms, you cannot do that because the normativity of the rule depends on the religious nature of the rule. Let's try to translate witnessing faith in secular terms. I don't want to put the bishop on the spot, but I'm pretty sure it would take you a couple of numbers to explain it in secular terms without making any reference to religious life. So once you get...
Sure.
So many religious laws cannot be taken out of the religious concept without becoming not understandable. So the first risk of translation is that you lose the meaning and the very normativity of the rule. The second is, why is a translation needed? I'm a comparative law scholar, and I'm familiar with trafficking in human rights throughout the globe. You have courts from everywhere taking advantage of experience, of religion, of legal experience from everywhere in the world. European Court of Human Rights normally quotes decision from the US, from any European country, from New Zealand recently, even from Hong Kong. And one of the main criticisms is that they are taken out of their context and brought within the jurisprudence of the European Court of Human Rights. So why do we need a translation when it comes to religious law? And even philosophical ideas are normally traded. I'll just give you an example. It's quite striking. But this gives you the idea that when it comes to religious law, we start treating them as they weren't ideas, fully acceptable ideas or fully acceptable laws. A recent decision of the Indian court quoted several decisions throughout the globe, and Kant's doctrine of free will, two divergent interpretations of Kantian criterion of justices, Bentham, natural law theory, Blackstone, in this order, Aristotle, Locke, John Rawls, Amartya Sen, and that's for America, that's for the American friends. Oliver Wendell Holmes was articulated in this way, that Justice Sikri, who delivered the decision, said, the life of the law has been logical, it has been experience, and then he articulates. But he got it wrong, but that's real Oliver Wendell Holmes. So he even misunderstood Oliver Wendell Holmes, who says, the life of the law has not been logic. Instead, he said his logic and experience, and then he articulates after that. So in a sweeping freedom of thought from courts when it comes to drawing from other legal traditions. And then, who is requested to fulfill the duty of translation? Who must So who is requested to fulfill the translation? Because normally courts don't request a translation, don't ask part to provide a translation. Just read for a moment these few lines. The theological debate was reflected in the writing of St. Augustine, who made a distinction between embryo and animatus, not yet endowed with the soul, and embryo and animatus. He may have drawn upon Exodus 21, 22, etc. Do you know where this comes from? It is Roe versus Wade, 1973. And I'm pretty sure, that the Catholic Church never provided a brief feeding the court to the point of saying, you know, abortion is okay for us, because that's what the court is saying. It's drawing from several religious traditions to articulate its own thinking. I'm not arguing against the thinking. I'm saying that they took an extreme liberty in drawing materials from religious thinking and even from religious law. And the churches didn't have to provide a translation. And of course, reading a court, rereading St. Augustine is quite, might be quite puzzling, but that's what he did. Roe versus Wade is a similar case about abortion for non-Americans. Who decides if the translation is okay? Of course, the secular sphere. That this goes back to what Michael said. You can dismiss arguments simply because it's on the religious side that falls the duty of translation. So if it's okay for me, it means that it's okay, and you have translated. So it's very important to understand what we mean with translation. And of course, we have a danger of selectivity, as I showed you before, because you can grasp something and you can just leave some of the ideas out of courtroom. So the conclusion is that translating legal concepts means, at the most, to understand them. They don't really need to be translated into secular terms. This doesn't give religious law a blank check. It just means that they have an access to the court, and then they can be weighed against other rights. And interestingly, that this brings back us to the case I mentioned before, this has nothing to do with the public sphere. So when we talk about translating legal religious terms for the sake of the public debate to shape our policies with reference to marriage, to birth control, whatever, we are talking about the contribution that religious life gives to the secular sphere or to the public sphere. You pick the word you prefer. But here, the case was about the inner life of the church. It was about running church activities, like choosing the teachers. So it was even more dangerous. Why does this happen? How many minutes? Okay, good. So why does this happen? Professor Chaillot says that courts do often, he means secular courts, do often consider semi-autonomous and alien legal regimes. I think that Jewish law, Muslim law, Islamic law, and canon law are not semi-autonomous or quasi-legal regimes. They are platinum collection legal regimes. They are very articulated legal ideas. They are not a second degree level of legal regimes. They are fully autonomous on top of that. So you are dealing with legal ideas that must be understood by you, but don't need a legal translation. They are legal in themselves. If so, they do belong to what is said to be the club that is shaping contemporary legal experience. Jeremy Waldron uses this wording, the idea of a club that shapes rights on a global sphere through reciprocal borrowings of legal ideas. If they aren't fully considered as members of this club, then you understand why they're considered semi-autonomous and alien legal regimes. My impression is that they are not. And I will stop here. I think I'm on time. I'm quite surprised about that. And I thank you so much. And I will really miss you for many reasons. The most trivial is that I'm flying back to Indiana, whereas the weather is not as much a wonderful and warm. So thank you.
Thank you to Michael Casey and Andrea Pin. We have a few minutes before lunch, and we'd like to open up the session for questions. Yes, please.
Thanks to both Dr. Casey and Dr. Pin. I always have a hard time. I have to choose one person to ask question because I have lots of questions. So I'm just going to direct it to you, Dr. Casey, Michael. Is it necessary to draw such a sharp distinction between, on the one hand, religious commitment to human flourishing in this world, and on the other hand, understanding that this commitment can stem and emerge fully from the deepest sense of transcendence? In other words, is it possible to envision a way in which, in this 21st century, we can think about the ways to bring together religious humanism and transcendental orientation?
I think the short answer to your question, whether these things can be brought together, is yes. And if the distinction was drawn a bit sharply in my paper, it's just because of the brevity of time and trying to, I suppose, we sometimes draw things a bit more sharply than they really are, just to try to clarify the concept. I think one medium for bringing these things together again is seeing if we can together agree that there is such a thing as truth. I think the exclusion of the concept of truth, the idea that there is no such thing as truth, that a truth beyond our own making, has a very bad effect on the possibilities for dialogue. If there's simply an agreement that there is truth, and perhaps, you know, a subsidiary agreement that this is not something any of us will ever possess exclusively, it is entering into a process of understanding, of continually deepening understanding, which is not concluded at the end of our lives and which others have to continue for us. If people of all sorts of views, whether they're religious or otherwise, can agree on that sort of basic framework, and then to discuss together what truth might be, I think there's a condition is made available for dialogue and friendship. I think part of the problem of excluding a concept of truth, even on the understanding that we can all disagree about what it might be about, does create a situation where we get polarised, friendship becomes harder. I think mutual understanding becomes harder because everyone's talking from their own perspective, and it's difficult to sort of see common ground within them. So, I mean, that's the short answer to it, and it's obviously much bigger than that, but I think that's perhaps one thing we can consider in trying to move to what you're interested in exploring too.
Yes, please. Others who have questions, would you raise your hands? Yes, we'll go here first and then here.
My name is Byung-sun Ho, Seogang University Law School in Seoul, Korea. My question is directed to Michael Casey. You mentioned about John Finney's reasoning and his philosophy of law. It must be a reasoned argument. And he discussed about the reasoning of opposition to same-sex marriage in America. I remember that in one American court, there was an expert witness opinion was presented by John Finnis, and on the other hand, that the moral philosopher, the feminist philosopher, Martha Nussbaum, presented that idea in favor of same-sex marriage. And the reasoning is different. The John Finney's reasoning is that the meaning of a marriage should be inherently the union of men and women. But on the other hand, Martha Nussbaum's reasoned argument is that the marriage should be protected on the basis of equality, on human rights. The reasoning is different. So you argue that the reasoned argument is necessary in order to persuade the audiences. So which reasoning should be based upon reason itself?
I think it's not a question of privileging one form of reasoning over another. I think the point I was actually trying to make was that the sort of argumentation that John Finnis makes is increasingly seen as suspect, as not a form of reasoning at all. There is an attempt to exclude reasoning about certain issues from certain points of view because it is seen as a disguised form of religious bigotry. So what I'm really focusing on is that I think that's quite misleading and wrong, and I don't think it helps or fosters or supports the possibilities of reasoned dialogue at all. So it's not a question of making a choice between, I mean, it's, people will have different views. I think the whole point of reason argument is that we can argue for our views in a reasoned fashion, and if other people are arguing on reasoned grounds too, to at least respect that. What I was trying to highlight is an attempt to disqualify a particular form of contribution to reasoned debate on the grounds that somehow or other it's not really reason.
Thank you. Yes. Thank you.
Neil Foster from Newcastle Law School in Australia. Question for Andrea. A very interesting, thank you very much. I connected what you said there with interesting developments in the UK recently with the Kyra and Shergill case, which I'm not sure whether you're familiar with, but Kyra and Shergill, which is a case that came up to the UK Supreme Court about whether the court could inquire into the internal religious reasons offered by a Sikh group to determine who was supposed to be in charge of a particular branch of the group or to get some property. And at the Court of Appeal level in the UK, the court had basically said, no, we can't touch this at all because it's all religious stuff and therefore we will refuse, you know, it's not justiciable, we'll refuse to deal with it. But when it got up to the Supreme Court level, I think they made the sensible comment that no, the people involved in this case have chosen to subject themselves to a certain regime, and as a court, it's our obligation, because there were trusts involved and other things like that, it's our obligation to go enter into the logic of that group and to determine, in accordance with the agreed regime they've adopted, who is the legitimate successor in those terms. So that the UK Supreme Court there, in effect, is going contrary to what Professor Saggio says, they're saying, no, this is actually a legitimate legal regime and the courts are entitled to take it into account. So I think there's an interesting contrast there between the view of some judges, and certainly other judges have taken this view that we just can't even touch religious reasoning because it's not real reasoning or something, and the other courts are saying, well, no, there are circumstances where the court has the authority and the duty to actually look into the logic within a religious group.
Yeah, I didn't remember the title of the case, but I'm aware of the case. And I would say that the point of the presentation was about the duty of translation, which makes things much more complicated. It complexifies the relationship between the religious field and the secular field. I think that given the fact that religious law is a law, it can't be detected by secular courts. It cannot be rewritten by secular courts. So it's interesting to notice that some secular courts in the Middle East in the past years have outlawed polygamy, just rereading the Quran. I don't think they can do that. It's not proper for a secular court to do that, but since it's legal material, you can do that. And actually, when it comes, there are statistics that say that America has enforced Islamic law as a foreign law of countries where Islamic law is enforced. So sometimes you have to deal with that.
Yes, we have a question here, Professor Durham.
So, Professor Durham, who I am. This is a question for Andrea. We were actually at a conference together with Judge Shio where he was talking about this, so it's very interesting. And one of the things, I've typically encountered this argument and said, you know, it's very odd that usually we look to the native speakers to impose the obligation of translation on the native speaker. In this case, it would be the speaker of secularese. I mean, if we were trying to translate into religious, then you'd require the religious. But if you're doing going into secularese, then you would want the secular speaker to have the burden of translation. Shayo said something quite interesting. He said, well, as a secular person, I may be blind to the religious things, so I really rely on the religious people to make the interpretation. I'd just be interested in your reaction as to what lies behind the who has the obligation to do the translation.
It's most complicated question that you could pose me. How many hours do you have? my sense is that being religiously blind as a secular is one thing. Being unaware of religious law is another thing. I mean, you don't need to be religious to know what canon law says. From this perspective, the courts on a comparative perspective have taken different paths. But the way it was posing, I was there, I think, the way it was posing the argument wasn't persuasive to me because whether I'm religious or not doesn't make a difference. I have some legal materials in front of myself. And if I don't get them, if I don't understand them, I agree with Sajo. I cannot understand them if you don't help me. But you don't need to help me to the point to translate in secular terms what religious law conveys. So what does it mean as I'm not Mormon? I can ask what hot drinks are. But when you tell me what hot drinks are, you don't need to provide me with a secular translation of the obligation that you have not to drink hot drinks. That's I don't need it.
Very good.
Shadman Bashir from Dixie State University via Pakistan. I would like a comment from Professor Andrea. I call it the battle of the translations. It starts with the translation and ends with the translation. And let me explain briefly. Judges in Pakistani courts cannot translate verses of Quran, and Islam is based on Quran. These translations can be only done by a religious scholar. And the religious scholars have to be qualified from religious schools based on different schools of thought. And each school of thought has its own translation. So it starts with the translation, it ends with the translation, and that's where the real problem begins. Like, for example, I have two Qurans in my house, and in one Quran, the word non-believer is defined as someone who doesn't believe in God. Not the question of Christian God, a Jewish God, a Muslim God, but the one who doesn't believe in God. In another Quran, a pretty recent one, non-believer, in the bracket it's called Jews and Christians. So anyone who reads that, and the two Qurans are from two different publishing houses which are supported by different schools of thought. So it keeps around in the circles. So if your comment on that, thank you.
My comment will be that both translations are religious. You don't expect them to give you a secular translation of the Quran. It's still religious. We can debate. The Catholic Church is gathering now to address the family law issues in the canon law field. So they do debate, but once it's a problem within the religious denomination, and it's still a religious thing, that I wouldn't overlook the fact that I'm talking of translating religious words into secular words. I know I didn't answer you, but
it's food for thought, which reminds us of lunch. Anyway, let's have one more question.
My question is to Michael Neville Rocco from Adelaide in Australia. Michael, I think that you've articulated Finnis very well, but I'm just wondering whether the appropriate riposte is found in the writings of Professor Stephen Smith from San Diego, where He says that in the secular debate that is carried out in a number of these contentious areas, there is a concept that he's writing about in most of his, in a couple of his recent books called smuggling. In other words, that there is a concept put forward, but it really is smuggling in a lot of other unspoken concepts under the guise of this very reasonable concept that may not be reasonable and may need to be unpacked, but one dare not unpack them because of political correctness or whatever it might be. One concept that he attacks quite vigorously is the concept of equality. And he effectively says that equality is really a chameleon concept. It's not a value you can espouse immediately because one thing needs to be equal to another, and then you need to analyse the equality of each in their relevant respects. Is that part of the answer to the loss of favour of that Finnis is starting to suffer in the debate?
I think, well, I don't know Professor Smith's work myself, but I think that certainly sounds like one possible way of resolving. If we're going to interrogate people's arguments for presuppositions or ideas behind the reasoned arguments which might be smuggled in, then I think that's a reasonable thing to do, but it should apply to everyone. And then we can have a discussion about those presuppositions. And I don't mind it being a discussion about religious presuppositions or non-religious presuppositions, because for some of the reasons that Professor Pinn's highlighted, it's important that religious arguments also be made in the public square and that they be discussed, frankly, on their own terms as well. So I think it's a question, you can't have it both ways. You can't interrogate someone's reasoning and say it's suspect because you suspect certain presuppositions behind it and then say, no, you can't do that to us. So I suppose if it's even-handed, that might be a way forward.
Well, thank you to our panelists for a stimulating and enlightening discussion. We hope that the discussion will continue in your off time. We do have lunch in the same location, I believe, isn't it? Same location as yesterday. We ask you to make your way over there following the signs of the students, and we appreciate your attention this morning. Can we give one more hand to these great panelists?
Michael, that was really outstanding.
Oh, thank you.